Hi.
Welcome back
to Behind the Crime.
I'm Ella Calora.
And I'm Rebecca Wood.
And
we're your hosts.
We are your hosts. Should we talk about how this is a special episode?
You should talk about it.
Oh, I'm going to talk about it. Guys, we've had our podcast for a year.
Tomorrow, on December 7th. This is going to come out on the 6th, just to keep consistent with our Wednesdays. But it's a year since our first episode came out. Which means we've been working on this for over a year, probably a year and a month.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's absolutely crazy to me. This is our
16th episode.
Yeah. I couldn't remember at all. That's why I was looking at you. I was like, Becky, help.
Episode 16.
Anyway, so we do have a little theme today. We're going to be talking about cases that have happy endings.
Well, as happy as True crime cases can get.
I was about to get to that. Like, just because it's, like, happy endings doesn't mean that, like, these people aren't changed for the rest of their lives in terrible ways. We just mean happy endings by, like, they survived through these events.
And have overcome.
Yes. Because I think both of ours, they went on to build foundations or just go to, like, conventions that, like, they've spoken on issues that our cases both involve.
So we didn't plan this, but we do both have kidnapping cases. And Ella is going first. So let's get into the episode.
My case is about Jan Broberg. I apologize if I ever call her Jane because it's J-A-N. So it's Jan, but my little brain keeps saying Jane.
So silly of you.
So this case is about Jan Broberg, but really it is about the Broberg family altogether. They all were involved, and without spoiling too much, were all manipulated and hurt in different ways. And we'll get into that. So the Brobergs lived in Idaho. They were a middle-class family. The mother was Marianne, the father was Bob. And they had three daughters, Jan, who was the oldest, and then Karen, who was 2 years younger, and then Susan, who was the youngest, again, 2 years younger than Karen. So this was in the 1970s. Middle-class family in Idaho. They were members of the Church of Jesus Christ. And in the 1970s, they had neighbors move in, the Berchtolds. And it was Bob Berchtold, so both of the father's names are Bob. Sorry, that might get confusing. His wife and their kids, all boys except for one little girl. So they were members of the same church. That's where they met. And then the families became, they got very close very fast. Both of the moms were very, like, got very close. Both of the fathers got very close, and then the kids were all around the same age, so everyone had a friend.
Yeah, I think each of the three boys were the age of one of the three girls.
Yeah, it kind of just worked out perfectly that they all had a friend. That's, in their words, that's what they said, that everyone had a friend. So yeah, they began getting very close, like close to the point where Mr. Berchtold, who they started to call B, so for the rest of the episode I'm going to call him B, he became really like a fixture in the home. They would see each other every day. He started driving the girls to school in the morning with his boys. He started getting very close to Jan. He started calling her Dolly and had other names for her, but Dolly was the main one. He would take them out to do fun activities, mostly Jan, but sometimes the other girls too. They would have sleepovers. Again, he would take them on trips. So a couple things before it gets really bad. So this was, I'm just going to say it. He winds up kidnapping Jan. But before the kidnapping, there were a couple things that led up to it. So Jan and Karen shared a room. And B decided that they were both, like, old enough that they should have their own room. So he
helped them. Oh, because that's totally his decision to make.
Yeah. So he helped them build a wall because the two girls shared a room. He helped them build a wall so he could be closer to to just Jan. He wanted Jan, like, on her own. There was a boating trip that he invited different neighbors to and Jan. But the neighbor later said in the documentary that I watched, it was very weird that the rest of the family wasn't there and it was just Jan. And he felt uncomfortable. And he even said that that was the last trip that he went on with the Birchtolds because he felt uncomfortable. So some of these sleepovers, one in particular, the Birchtolds had a big trampoline and they would let their boys sleep on it. And they invited the girls. And one night, Jan woke up and she could feel that her underwear was down around her ankles.
Oh.
And when she woke up, she was aware that B had his hands on her. And he told her that she was turning a lot and that she must have, like, pulled off her underwear by herself.
Oh, my God.
There was a trip to Seattle. The Birchtolds invited Jane and
Jan.
Oh my goodness. Don't even correct me because it's going to throw me off every time. So they invited Jan to go to Seattle with them. And at first, Jan's father, well, actually, not even at first, the entire time, Jan's father did not want her to go, said no. B convinced Jan's mom, Marianne, to let her go. So she winds up going. The Birchtolds told Jane's family when they got back that she got sick one night at dinner and she was acting groggy and she was in and out of consciousness. So B took her back to the room while the rest of the family was finishing eating. And Jan later did say that she woke up to see B naked.
Oh, no.
So fall of 1972, this was 2 years before the kidnapping, the mom, Marianne, Jan's mom, this is when stuff between her and B started happening. B would call her up to ask her to bring her lunch, and she would, and he would give her compliments and tell her that he was attracted to her, and he was manipulating her. And one time they were going to a church function in Utah, and Marianne and B took a ride to the mountains, and things got a little carried away, and they had sex. And then the relationship between Marianne and B kind of remained like that. Marianne did try to not have, like, advances, like, put on her. It's very hard to explain, but it was all very gross is, like, the best word to describe it.
Well, especially knowing, like, what we know.
Yeah.
It's gross.
So then Bob, Jan's father, Bob, him and B, like I said, were also very close. And one day, B showed up at Bob's shop. He owned a flower shop. And he asked him to take a ride, so they took a ride. And B wound up asking Bob to help him relieve himself. That's how I'm going to put it. And Bob did. Again, B was just very manipulative. And, like, the whole family has said, like, he was a master manipulator. And Bob has said now, like, in his words, he said, "I did the worst thing I've ever done." And he said, breaking the trust and fidelity between him and Marianne, which they both did. Hmm. So now we're going to get into the kidnapping. In October of 1974, B was supposed to take Jan on a one-day horseback riding trip. When they didn't return that night, Jan's parents were concerned, but they also had a lot of trust in B, and they didn't think that he would harm their daughter. they wound up calling B's wife, and she kind of convinced them not to call the police that night, telling them that he would be back, he'd be back, and he would never hurt her. So they wound up not calling the police until Sunday or Monday. They called the FBI. So they went horseback riding on Thursday. They didn't call anyone until Saturday. They called the FBI. Their office was closed, and they told them to call a different office that wasn't closed. But they didn't want to cause a big scene, so they didn't. And then they waited until Monday to call. What had happened was B picked up Jan from her piano lesson, and he gave her allergy pills because Jan's father, Bob, was allergic to horses, so they assumed that Jan was also allergic to horses, so she needed to take allergy pills. And I think she also did have other allergies too, but they were not allergy pills. They were sleeping pills.
Right.
So Jan fell asleep, and she woke up strapped down in the back of a motorhome that B had owned, and they were headed to Mexico. Jan didn't know this at the time. She woke up, and at first she was strapped down, and she could hear voices from aliens. They were aliens from a dying planet, so there was a tape recorder playing all of this in the room where she was. And they said that they had been watching her since she was born, and that she had been chosen to be impregnated with a child who would save their planet. And according to the voices on the intercom, B would be the one, the male companion, as they put it, to impregnate Jan. And they also told her that the reason why she was chosen was because she was part alien, and that her earthly father was not her real father, that her real dad was from this dying planet, so she was half alien. So she was in and out of sleep hearing all of this told to her. She wakes up again, and this time the straps are gone. She gets up, and she finds B in the back of the motorhome, covered in blood and passed out, and she wakes him up and she tells him all of this, and he kind of like comforts her but is also telling her that they have to do this, like it's true, and they will be killed, because the voices also told her that if she doesn't do this, her father will die, she will die, her sister, one of her sisters will go blind, the other one will be kidnapped and have to take her place. All of this stuff to make her scared. And B reinforced that. And he was, like, pretending like he was also scared. And all of that to...
Manipulator again.
Manipulator, yeah. So while that is going on, the Brobergs are freaking out, trying to get answers from B's wife. She's not being very helpful. They eventually get the FBI, call the FBI and let them know. But at first, they don't really have a strong case because they're, like, not concerned. They are concerned that they haven't returned, but they don't think that he would hurt her. There's not a whole lot the FBI can do, because like they're saying that she's been kidnapped, but they're also saying that she hasn't been kidnapped. So this continues for a month as B and Jan get into Mexico. He winds up marrying her because child marriage was legal there at the time, which is insane to me. B eventually, I'm giving the very short version of this.
It's such a complicated thing.
I'm trying to give the very short version of this. There is a documentary, there is a show, there is many articles. We will link them all. Please go watch them, because this case is absolutely insane and there's so much that goes into it. So Jan and Bea are in Mexico. The parents still don't know where they are. The Brobergs still don't know where they are. They're working with the FBI, trying to find them. Bea eventually winds up contacting his brother and is telling him that he will come back with Jan if the Brobergs allow them to get married in the U.S. And, of course, the Brobergs are like, absolutely not. This is our 12-year-old daughter. You're not marrying her.
Not to mention, aside from the fact that she's a child, he's married already as well.
Yes.
So, like...
Yeah, so that was in...
He'd have to go through a whole divorce first, so he didn't think about that part.
Yeah. This was around day 35 of them being gone. And this is 1974, if I hadn't said that. So the police were able to track the call to Mexico, and Bea was arrested by Mexican police. This is another very frustrating part of this case. So the Mexican police arrest them and take them both to a prison. Bea winds up convincing one of the guards by giving him his gold ring to let him see Jan. And he goes into the cell where Jan is and is, like, telling her that she can't tell anyone about the mission, as they called it, that these aliens have given them. She can't talk about the mission. She can't talk about, pretty much, she can't talk about, like, anything that has happened between her and Bea, and she can't talk about the aliens, and she's not allowed to have contact with any other man. Otherwise, all of the terrible things that they told her will happen about her father and her sisters and her. So, again, she is terrified. Her parents eventually get her back, and they go home, and they can tell that she is not the same. She won't go near her father. She doesn't want to talk about anything that happened in Mexico, and they are very concerned. They had her examined, and there was no evidence of sexual abuse, and Jan was very persistent on sticking up for Bea. She said that he didn't hurt her, that nothing happened, and so it was very frustrating because... they knew that something happened.
Yeah.
But they had no evidence. The Brobergs were told not to talk to any of the Berchtolds. They did not listen. At this point, they're going through this trial to try to get Bea arrested on kidnapping charges. Gail, Bea's wife, I don't think I've said her name. Sorry. Her name is Gail. She was asked, Bea asked her, to go ask the Brobergs to drop the charges, or else he would reveal all of the dirty laundry between him, Bea, and the Brobergs, the two parents. So everything that they did. And the Brobergs, instead of sticking up for their daughter, decided to save themselves, which is very frustrating because mm-hmm. that is your daughter. So, with no case at this point, they were forced to drop the charges, and the trial just went nowhere because there was no case at this point. No one would talk. Jan said that she wasn't kidnapped at all. And
even though she literally was, like, you were taken from your family?
Yeah.
Like... even if nothing bad happened, which obviously something bad did happen, even if nothing bad happened, you were still kidnapped, even if you were fine with it.
So after this, the Brobergs received a lot of messages from people in the community just berating them that they didn't stick up for their daughter. How could they be these, like, terrible parents? And honestly, I agree.
They got a point.
Like... that's your daughter, and you couldn't... They were looking out for themselves instead of looking out for their daughter, which is really frustrating.
Yeah.
So at one point in the night, Bea... So at this point, sorry, I'm skipping. At this point, B is with his brother working at his shop, but he comes home on the weekends and he's still in church. The Brobergs were still not supposed to speak to any of the Berchtolds. At one point, B went into Jan's room and left her a note, basically like a love letter, and also like reminding her about the mission, how she can't forget about the mission.
Yeah, because she'd somehow forget that. Like,
yeah,
that trauma that you just put on her, she's going to just forget.
During this time, Jan would tell her mom that she loved B and wanted to marry him and wanted to have kids with him.
Oh, no, no, no.
And was just absolutely convinced that she was in love with this man and that he loved her and that.
Oh.
And also, like, convinced about this whole alien thing and the mission that they needed to complete. Just absolutely insane. So, Marianne, very frustrated because she still didn't know what happened in Mexico. Even though she was told not to talk to any of the Berchtolds, she went to go visit B for answers about Jan. Mm-hmm. When he was living in his motorhome, when she got there, she asked him at first what happened in Mexico. Immediately, B just started giving her compliments and told her that she's the one that he's in love with, not anyone else. She's the one that he wants, basically lying to her. And again, things got out of hand and they had sex and they continued this for many weeks, actually many months.
You know what's like the most disgusting part of the fact that they were doing that is that they were doing that in the motorhome where whatever happened, Jan, happened.
Yeah.
So, like, she was doing that with him on the same bed that he assaulted her daughter.
Mm-hmm. Marianne will admit to this day that at that time, she thought that she was in love with B.
But why? Like,
he was just so good at manipulation. So, then B decides to call Bob and told him what was going on. And then their marriage really started to fall apart.
Well, it's not surprising.
Yeah. And Bob, at this time, I guess, got smarter than he had been this entire, like, for years. And he knew that B wanted Jan and not Marianne. But yeah. Marianne, he felt that she was bringing their family down and not getting them away from B and bringing them closer to him instead. So he divorced Marianne, well, tried to divorce Marianne to save the girls, and he took them out of town. 2 to 3 days later, B calls and he starts threatening Bob that he's going to lose his wife and lose his children. And then he calls Marianne and tells her to leave and go with him and be with him. And Marianne tells him, no, I want to be with my husband and with my girls. And then she goes home to Bob and the girls, and they just have this moment where they're both like, we're never letting him back into my life. And that kind of, they like made up and they were all good, I guess. As good as they...
Good for them, I guess.
As good as they could be.
Yeah.
So then, June 1976, 20 months after the kidnapping, B pled guilty, and he was sentenced to 4 to 5 years, which was then reduced to 45 days.
Bruh.
But then he only served 10 days... for good behavior.
How good could his behavior have been in 10 days? Like,
so before he actually served these days, he had 3 months before he had to report to prison to serve his, what was supposed to be 45 days. B at this time moved to Wyoming and bought a family fun center. Mm-hmm. And Jan really wanted to work there for the summer. Obviously, the Brobergs were like, no, absolutely not. But apparently Jan wouldn't let it go. And Marianne eventually sent Jan.
Bro.
After a few weeks, she wanted her back. They brought her back home. Jan was very angry. She wanted to stay. B kept calling. And then the second abduction happens, August 10th, 1976, only after a few weeks of Jan being back home. The Brobergs went to sleep. The next morning, Jan was gone. She left a note. I should have pulled up the note. But it was basically, first of all, it said, "Dear Bob and Marianne."
Oh.
Not "Dear Mom and Dad," which I also find interesting. And it was basically telling them that she loves B and she wants to be with him and all of that, like all the lies that B has told her. The Brobergs get a call from B, and he somehow knows that Jan is missing, and he tells them that he doesn't know where she is, which is a lie.
Well, if you know she's missing, you clearly know where she is, because how else would you know?
Yeah. So then, a little bit later, on September 1st, B begins his sentence. This is, at this point, 3 weeks, still no Jan. Mm. He only serves 10 days in jail, and then he moves to Salt Lake, and then kind of disappears. He still, at this point, is calling the Brobergs, and he would call and, like, cry and say that he doesn't know where Jan is and that he just wants to be with her. November 1976, 90 days after Jan disappears, they finally find B's motorhome, and they put up a surveillance camera because at this point they don't have any evidence that he kidnapped her. Mm-hmm. And he was still saying that he didn't know where she was. When they went into the motorhome, they found posters of Jan, like a shrine.
Oh. That's so weird.
So, at one point, Jan did call home after she had been gone for months. And she kind of called and just said that she was good and she missed them. And that's pretty much all she said. And then hung up.
Right.
So what was actually going on, B enrolled Jan in an all-girls school, and he would visit her on weekends. He told the nuns that he was a CIA agent, and they were on the run, and that he was her dad.
And they just believed he was a CIA agent? Like, he didn't have a fake ID for it?
Maybe he did, but they just believed.
So
he was eventually arrested because of a call that he made to Jan. And they found the both of them, and they brought Jan home. This time that Jan was brought home, she didn't interact with any of the family. She just went to her room. She was described as hollow and emotionally gone. So January 24th, 1977, 38 days after Jan returned home, Bob gets a call in the night from one of his workers saying that the store was on fire. His flower shop was on fire. When they got there, it was completely up in flames, and what had happened was B convinced two guys that he was in prison with to go set Bob's store on fire, and he would pay them. They couldn't tie it back to B.
Right.
Because he didn't do it, but he paid two people to do it. So that's kind of the end of the case. The frustrating part is B was never convicted of either kidnapping, was never charged with arson, was never charged with the impersonation of a CIA agent, was never charged with anything like that. The summer, as for Jan, the summer she turned 16, she still had all these thoughts in her head that the mission was still going on. But then this was also the summer where she realized that because the mission was that she had to have a child by the time she was 16.
Oh.
So around this time, she was, like, still believed in it, but then there were a couple events where she started to realize that it wasn't true. Like, she went to summer camp and found this boy that she really liked.
Good
for
her.
And then she started freaking out, thinking that something bad would happen because she wasn't supposed to interact with a boy. But then nothing bad did happen, and then she turned 16, and she... This is actually really sad. A couple days before she turned 16, she had a thought that if she wasn't pregnant, she was going to buy a gun.
No.
Ask her sister if, like, tell her sister about it, and if her sister didn't want to take her place, she was going to kill herself and kill her sister.
Oh, wow.
That did not happen because she turned 16, and she said that she went to bed that night, woke up the next morning. It was her 16th birthday. Her family was all still there, and she kind of just knew that everything was okay.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the end of that, but this continues 28 years later. Jan and her mom, Marianne, decided to write a book. It's called Stolen Innocence. And it's just all about what happened to Jan and about B. B would try to show up at the conventions or the like book readings and signings that they had. He would try to show up. He would make threats that if they didn't stop with this book, that he would make their life like a living hell. And yeah, so he would try to show up, he would call them and make threats, he would post things and, like, hand out flyers, basically saying that everything that they were saying was lies, and he exposed what happened between him and Marianne and Bob, and was just trying to make them scared again, manipulate them again.
Yeah. So he lost all the sense of control that he had over them.
Yeah. In 2004, Jan had to file a stalking injunction. She hadn't seen B in 30 years at this point, but he had to be at this trial. Usually stalking injunctions you get for 3 years, and then you have to refile, or I guess, like, you feel like you don't have to file anymore. But she actually got one for the rest of his life.
Good.
So fast forward to 2005, B shows up at a convention that Jan was speaking at, and he showed up with a gun, which is why he was arrested. He was charged with 3 felonies and 2 misdemeanors, mostly for the gun and the stalking violation. Yeah. He was never charged with kidnapping, again, never charged with arson, never charged with impersonating a CIA agent. He was charged for 2 misdemeanors and 3 felonies. Mm-hmm. Before he could be sent to prison, he said that he would never spend a day in prison. He would rather die. He committed suicide before he went to prison. After this, 6 women contacted Jane Broberg and told her that B had also sexually assaulted them.
Oh.
And in one case, he was actually convicted of rape and spent a year in jail.
Just one year. I have so many things to say about that, but...
And that's where this story ends. Jane went on to be an actress, and like I said, her mom and her wrote a book. There's been a show about this. There was a documentary about this.
The show is called A Friend of the Family. It's on Peacock.
Yeah, and we'll also link the documentary, and the book is called Stolen Innocence. This case is just, it makes me mad. The parents make me mad because they didn't protect their daughter. The law enforcement makes me mad in Mexico that they let him see her. I mean, his wife... B's wife makes me mad because she was kind of halting the investigation, even though she didn't directly do anything and didn't know. she still was stalling.
She knew to a certain degree.
Yeah.
That something was going on.
And of course, he makes me the most mad, obviously.
Yeah.
And it just makes me mad that he was never charged. And that's really Jane's parents' fault that he was never charged for kidnapping, because they wanted to protect themselves mm-hmm. more than they wanted to protect their daughter.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to my case, which is another kidnapping case of a young girl around the same age. She was a little bit older, but her name is Elizabeth Smart. And I'm going to start with just a little tiny amount of background. She was born on November 3rd, 1987 in Salt Lake City, Utah. And her family was also members of the Church of the Latter-day Saints. So they were both in the same religion, which mm-hmm. is interesting. And her parents were Edward and Lois Smart. She had four brothers, which aren't included a lot in the story, so I don't have their names down. But her sister, her name was Mary Smart, and she was in the room with her when Elizabeth got kidnapped. So the kidnapping is kind of told from her perspective, and it happened on June 5th in 2002 when Elizabeth was 14. She shared a room with her sister, and from Mary, her sister's perspective, she heard a man's voice in their bedroom threatening Elizabeth, and he apparently had a knife to her neck and threatened her with it. And she was just so scared that she pretended she was sleeping. She pretended she didn't hear any of this. And then Elizabeth was taken. She didn't know how they left the room, how he got in or anything like that. But a couple hours later, she finally worked up the courage to go tell her parents that Elizabeth was taken.
I've heard of this case before. I didn't realize I did.
Yeah, because it's not very long ago that it happened. It was 2002, mm-hmm. so. Her parents kind of just assumed that Mary had a nightmare, and they were like, okay, well, we'll go check the room just to make sure everything's fine, you know. Because they were like, there's just no way that that actually happened, and they heard nothing. But they couldn't find Elizabeth anywhere in the house, so they realized that it was true and she was taken. They immediately called 911, and police were searching for Elizabeth within the hour.
Hmm.
So now to get into the search a little bit, investigators basically determined that the abductor, the man, got into the house through an unlocked window. He cut a hole in the screen, probably with the same knife that he had against her neck, and just climbed through and then found his way to her room, meaning somehow he knew where her room was. Otherwise, it would have been a lot more chance of the parents hearing him. So the Smarts were in the process of renovating their house so that they could sell it. So police immediately decided that everyone who had been in the house, including contractors, real estate agents, repairmen, anyone else who had been in the house because of their renovation process, they were going to go to top of their list and investigate all of them, especially because they were likely all men as well, or mostly men. Mm-hmm. The family also offered a $250,000 reward to anyone who could provide information that led to finding Elizabeth. Eventually, the police narrowed it down to a few suspects who were all men who worked in the house within the past few months, but none of them fit the description that Mary gave of the man, because she did see him and heard his voice. So if it was someone who was in their house, you know, likely she would have been able to remember his voice as well.
Mm-hmm.
So 4 months after her disappearance, this whole time Elizabeth is still kidnapped. They have no idea where she's gone, where she's been, or who's taken her. Mary had a sudden realization that she knew who kidnapped Elizabeth. She was like, oh, I know. Like, she didn't know at first. She had no idea, just gave the description, and it finally came to her that she knew who it was. And she told her parents that she was pretty sure it was a homeless man that the family knew as Emmanuel. He worked on the house for one day a few months before Elizabeth was kidnapped, so he was only in their house once. He was a homeless man who was also of the Mormon faith, and he would frequently preach to other local homeless people, and like he was known for that. And his real name was Brian Mitchell, but the family obviously didn't know that. They only knew him as Emmanuel. So early on in the investigation, Brian Mitchell was a suspect, but there was a typo when they searched his name, so his arrest record didn't come up, so he was scratched from their suspect list. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And for a while, they didn't believe Mary that she suddenly knew who it was, they were like, no, she's just a kid. She doesn't know. So they continued focusing on their prime suspect, who was Richard Ritchie, who was dead. So they, yeah, but like she was still missing this whole time. So maybe not a good suspect, but whatever. Basically, the Smart family decided to take matters into their own hands and started searching on their own and also reaching out to like news outlets and specifically to the host of America's Most Wanted.
Oh.
Yeah. And this actually helped a lot with solving the case. Brian's ex-wife recognized him from the sketches of Mary's description and called the police and told them about his past of sexual abuse and that he looks exactly like the sketches. She also said that if he is the one who kidnapped Elizabeth, then she is alive. She was like, there's no chance he killed her. If he kidnapped her, she's still alive. And she was pretty sure it was him. By the time that Brian had become the prime suspect, he had relocated to California with Elizabeth and his wife, who helped him kidnap her, Wanda Barzee, who also her son recognized Brian from the sketch on America's Most Wanted and also made a report of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really good thing that they went to the host of that show with that sketch because it helped a lot with the investigation. So now we're getting on to Brian and Wanda. They abducted Elizabeth, and when they did that, they dragged her through the forest that was right by the house, and they went to their campsite that they had. And there, they forced Elizabeth to change into a white robe that matched Brian and Wanda's, and then tied her to a tree, and he took Elizabeth as his second wife because he believed that polygamy was still okay, I guess, even though it was outlawed in the Mormon church in the 1890s, I think. But he basically brainwashed her into believing that he would kill her entire family if she tried to escape. So a similar thing to Jan Broberg is the fear of her family getting hurt, which is a common thing that happens with sexual abusers. That is how they manipulate a lot of their victims.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian also apparently believed that he was a prophet, which explains why he was always preaching to other homeless people. I guess the only people that would actually listen to him.
Yeah.
They frequently took her in public, but no one ever recognized her because they had her wear a veil to cover her identity. And they walked around in their white robes that they had on, and Wanda also wore a veil. So in California, the couple decided they found his third wife, a 12-year-old girl whose father was a Latter-day Saints clergyman. And he actually got himself invited to the girl's house because he pretended that he was considering joining their congregation. Then several weeks later, he tried to break into the house, but he was unsuccessful, so he just completely gave up on finding his third wife. He also, a few weeks later, broke into a preschool and was arrested, but he gave a different fake name, and he was held in jail for only a few days awaiting his hearing. And while he was held in jail, Wanda was super worried about him because he didn't come home for several days, so she left and went to another campsite to pray. And Elizabeth didn't try to escape because she was so brainwashed and so scared that he was going to kill her entire family that she just stayed. A little bit more onto America's Most Wanted. On the show, photos of Brian were sent in and shown on TV once the police finally agreed that he should be their main suspect. And a man called in to report that he saw a similar looking man who was wearing a white robe with two women also wearing white robes and veils. So he was like, I saw them, and he kind of gave the location. And because of the show, Brian and Wanda finally decided, well, not finally, but they kind of got a little bit smart and they decided to stop wearing the robes because they knew that would draw a lot of attention to themselves. And they left California. So they arrived in Sandy, Utah in March 2nd. And multiple people actually called the police to report them because they recognized him. And police arrived very quickly and they took Elizabeth away from her kidnappers. But for a while, she refused to admit who she was. She was concealing her identity because she still was so scared of him killing her family, even though he was also you know, he was also in jail. She was still so scared. But eventually that same day, she did finally admit who she was and kind of broke down. And Ed Smart was brought into the station, and he assumed he was there to identify Brian, as he knew Emmanuel. And when he walked in the station, he saw Elizabeth, and that's how they were reunited. So he was really there to identify Elizabeth and take her home. So in total, she spent 9 months in captivity, where she was being sexually assaulted the entire time and basically threatened and manipulated that her whole family was going to get killed if she did anything, said anything to anyone, tried to escape. And she believed it because, I mean, why wouldn't you? Mm. At that point, he had already held a knife to her throat and literally kidnapped her. So why wouldn't he be willing to kill her family like he's been threatening? So on March 18th, Brian and Wanda were charged with aggravated kidnapping, aggravated burglary, and sexual assault. Multiple times, it was ruled that they were unfit to stand trial. So for a while, they just kind of were in jail, but they weren't convicted yet. And eventually, in 2009, so years later, on November 17th, Wanda was finally convicted and sentenced to 15 years in prison. But she did, unfortunately, only serve 6 years and was released from prison in 2018. So she's out there again.
Yeah.
And then, I know, like, 6 years. Even 15 years, like, isn't enough, but okay. So in 2010, in March, I don't know the exact date, Brian was also finally ruled fit to stand trial, and he was sentenced to life in federal prison, so he is still in prison today, and hopefully will stay there.
Good.
I couldn't find whether it was life with or without parole, but I'm hoping it's without, considering his previous record as well, because he had other charges. So this is kind of going on the happy ending side. Obviously, Elizabeth is still living with this great trauma, but she's gone on to do some really amazing things. She's become an advocate for missing children and victims of sexual abuse and has promoted several bills that would help victims and also improved the sex offender registry system, and has spoken to Congress about these issues multiple times. She also advocates for a more comprehensive sex education, because she basically said that her school's sex education was abstinence only, and that was another reason she didn't try to escape after being assaulted. She basically felt that she was worthless and that she had done something wrong and no one would ever want her because she wasn't a virgin anymore, which wasn't her choice or her fault. She has since worked past most of this feeling, and she's gotten married and has 3 kids. She's also the co-founder of the Elizabeth Smart Foundation, which, among other many things, which includes advocating for sexual assault victims and missing children, it also teaches self-defense, which I think is really good.
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming she didn't have any self-defense training, like most people don't, especially when they're 14. She's gotten married and had 3 children, like I said, so she has moved on a lot with her life, and she's published 2 books. The first one was published in 2013, and it was called My Story. And then in 2018, she published her 2nd book, which is called Where There's Hope, Healing, Moving Forward, and Never Giving Up. Despite the fact that she will always be living with this trauma, just like Jan Broberg, she has moved on with her life and is doing really great things to support other people who have gone through similar abuse and to improve the system of what happens after that happens to someone.
Yeah.
But that's my case, which has, it's obviously like a very, very, very sad case, and it's awful, but it at least has an uplifting ending.
And at least they were charged.
Yeah, and convicted. Unfortunately, Wanda serving 6 years is nothing compared to the trauma that she's enduring. But
no, but.
And I can't imagine how it must have felt to grow up for her sister, knowing that you know, she was there when it happened. It could have just as easily been her, and mm-hmm. that she, you know, just pretended to be asleep because, I mean, what else was she going to do?
Yeah.
It's not like she was going to be able to defend her.
Yeah, Jan's sisters, they say they're also in the documentary mm-hmm. and have both said that, like, it could have easily been one of them. And
yeah,
that they actually feel silly because at the time when it was happening and B would give Jan more attention, the sisters sometimes would be yeah. jealous.
Well, but I mean, looking, it makes sense that they would be.
Yeah, looking back, they're like, that could have been me, and kind of feel like,
yeah,
I can't imagine. Yeah, so even though they were in quotations, like, happy endings, there's still a lot of trauma left. And obviously, like, guilt. I know yeah. in my case, the parents both still feel guilty to this day and have said that they will feel guilty for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And Jan and Elizabeth, even though they've both gone on to do amazing things and become advocates for children who have been sexually abused or children who have been
kidnapped,
there's still always going to be that trauma.
Yeah.
And
that you can never, never truly get over, and that no one can ever really understand unless they've been through the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. Like, even
they're never going to be able to forget about
yeah,
it.
Yeah. I'm sure Elizabeth Smart and Jan Broberg, they could understand each other to a certain degree, but they're, instances were just so different that no one is ever going to understand exactly what you went through.
Mm-hmm. It's also like building up that trust enough mm-hmm. to like trust anyone ever again.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Especially in Jan's case, because it was someone that she trusted so yeah. much.
But in both, I can't imagine yeah. like what they had to go through mm-hmm. to be able to trust people again.
Yeah.
And forgive people too.
Like,
forgiving their parents or mm-hmm. her sister for not saying, I don't know. Like,
yeah. I mean, there's no way to know, like, everything that they've felt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just glad that they have gone on to have success in their lives
yeah.
and happiness.
Yeah.
And also, back to Jan Broberg, the show, Ella and I have actually been watching it, the show called A Friend of the Family. Jan Broberg played a big part in the show. Like, when
it.
You first watch it, the first episode, you're met with her sitting in, like, a director's chair talking to you, explaining, mm-hmm. like, I know a lot of this seems crazy and unbelievable, but it's all true.
Yeah.
So and it was just such a new thing.
It's not overly dramatized. Like, it all happened. No. They're not.
And it's also done in a respectful way that you know it's not upsetting to Jan Broberg, which is often a problem with true crime
yes yeah.
Like recreations, but because she was involved, it's not something that you really need to feel guilty about watching, because she was a part of creating
she
wants her story out there.
Yeah. So thank you for listening. I almost said watching.
I know, I saw.
How's it been a year and I still say watching?
Comment down below on our Instagram post how many times Ella called Jan Jane.
I don't think I did a lot. Maybe I did. I don't know.
At least 3 times I heard.
Okay.
Anyways, thank you for listening.
Follow us on Instagram.
At behind_thecrime
and
on Facebook. I was letting you say the Facebook.
No, I was going to say and on Facebook, and then you say it because I can never remember.
The Facebook is just Behind the Crime.
Well, how am I supposed to know?
I don't know. We do have a website published.
Yeah.
If you click the link in our bio on Facebook and Instagram, it'll take you there. You can check it out. It has links to all of our episodes. It also has our bios and some other information that you might want to check out. We may have a YouTube channel coming soon.
You may be able to watch soon, and then I'll say listening.
Yeah, so thank you for listening. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Bye.
Bye.